Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. Mr. Miller teaches at the Social Work School, depending on the University of Chicago. And we all know that Chicago is some heart of social work. Okay, I give you the floor.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's really wonderful to be with you. I'm grateful to Professor Fasson for this invitation and Patrizia Foti for wonderful hospitality and arranging things. And as I think about hospitality, I think that that's something that we desperately need, something that I think is certainly an answer to some of our most pressing questions. And I think the idea of hospitality, something, Didier, you've shown over your remarkable career, a kind of giving of yourself and opening, a welcoming of, in many cases, the other, which is powerful, important people who are held in fear and disdain, where they aren't loathed. And certainly, your hospitality is something that I've benefited from as I build my career. I think that this is a good place to start our discussion, or perhaps a good place for me to begin and end mine. So I'm doing a project on Black freedom, and the project is and on Black freedom's relationship to violence and how we respond to it, and the moral worlds we construct around and about it, around the question of Black freedom, around Black emancipation and what that means, the problems that we view of or that we think about when we think about Black freedom. And to think about it, I want to talk about a little bit about the genesis of this project. And the title comes from a scripture. I come from a religious family, and the scripture is Matthew 25 for people who are familiar with the Christian tradition. And I won't read the scripture, but there's a popular passage that asks the so-called righteous whether they cared for the vulnerable. And so in that passage, there are a set of questions that the king asks of people that, on the one hand, the king lets in to paradise, and on the other hand, the king doesn't. And the questions go, when I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was naked, did you clothe me? When I was a foreigner, did you invite me in? But there's another that says, when I was sick and in prison, did you visit me? And that was something that I hadn't sat with in my own life. I hadn't sat with the idea of visiting prisons, doing anything for people who we had decided to lock away. And this started me on the trajectory of my work, to imagine a world that perhaps punishes less. And the older I get, it started me on a journey to imagine a world perhaps that doesn't think about punishing people at all. But at the very least, I think we have to think about what punishment is. And so anyway, I started as a volunteer chaplain. This was in 2003. I did that for about 5 years, where I visited people who were in the Cook County Jail. At the time, Cook County was the largest single-site jail facility in the United States. It had an average daily population of about 10,000 people. That's since been reduced. I did that work for about 5 years. But while there, I needed to know something about what was happening inside. The longer I stayed at the Cook County Jail, the more I saw people who looked like me. So this is a city that's about a third Black, and about 80% of the population of the jail was Black. It was a third Black, but 80% of the jail population was Black. And I started to see my neighbors. And this was in some ways inevitable, because I was born poor and Black after 1972. This is the year that mass incarceration begins in earnest. I started to see people I grew up with. Eventually, my brother would go to prison, two of them, in fact. And I met my father, who I learned had done time. He had done 20 years. So I really needed to get my head around what I was looking at. So I went to school to study what we call mass incarceration in the United States. I won't talk about my experiences today. I write a little bit about that. But I will say, a few years later, I returned to that jail that I worked in for 5 years, and I sat with the director of educational programs. This is a site where kids who by law and right must be in school, because they are in fact minors, and the state holds custody of them. So the state has a responsibility to the children to provide them with time in school. And I remember what he said to me. The director of educational programs sort of talked to me about what happened when he came to work. He said, "When I come to work each day, I think about my grandson." He says that all of my family is sitting around. There's a whole group of people that are sitting around waiting for him to do something well. and we cheer, he says. He says, my guys don't have that. My guys, talking about these children who are incarcerated, 15, 16, 17 years old, he says, my guys are so well known, but so poorly understood. The boys who had committed acts of violence needed the same thing, he said, that his grandson did. But because he knew they were in jail, because there was no one to cheer them on, no one who would make a place for them. They were just children, even as young as 15 or 16. These boys, he said, were so well known, but so little understood. So I wasn't surprised 20 years later when I would see the depth of our disdain for these very same children. These children are misunderstood, as he said. They're viewed as violent, as threats, instead of children in need. And I wasn't surprised when I saw this lawsuit. This is a lawsuit brought about by the guardian ad litem in the state of Illinois. This is because of our inability to see these children as children, which is to say to see these people who may have caused harm as people. And I think this leads us to a very dark place. In this case, the guardian ad litem is suing the Department of Children and Family Services. Why? Because DCFS is taking custody of these children, as I mentioned, but in failing to find them a place to live, because no one will take them in, the children, some of whom have committed a crime, some of whom have committed a crime and done their time, some of whom hadn't committed a crime at all but had been found innocent, sit in the Cook County Jail, some even to this day, because there's no, quote, suitable placement for them. In other words, they did their time for the crime they committed, but these children are unwanted. Even the foster care system would not take them in, because these are children for which we've learned to be afraid. And our fear makes sense. We're afraid of the violent, people who've caused harm. This is the group I'm most curious about, the violent, about people we've learned to fear. But we must understand why we fear them. And to do that, we must understand how we come to presume that they are guilty of some violent thing, or guilty of the possibility of committing acts of violence. So I want to think about this kind of guilt. I want to think about Black guilt specifically, and conversely, the absence of innocence for Black children, and the ways that guilt flows within and between people and institutions, and the association of Black guilt with violence, or better still, the way that the flow of Black guilt supports and produces violence itself. And to do that, I want to open with a police encounter. A video surfaces from Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's March of 2017. The view is from an officer's chest cam. We see down the barrel of his already drawn gun that there are five Black boys in the distance. Guys, get on the ground. Keep your hands up, the officer says. These orders are coming calm but quickly. And the footage reveals the boys' personality. One's obedient but shaken. He lies face down during most of the ordeal. Another fidgets. He's unsure of whether to stay on his belly or walk toward the officer. What did we do, bro? Asks a third prone boy, his head and arms raised awkwardly. There's a fourth boy who whimpers. I don't want to die. Was this the youngest child? The boys reportedly are between 12 and 14 years old. The fifth boy, the one in black, is noticeably angry. Can you please put your gun away? He repeats his request. Hey, shouts the officer, don't come over here. The murmuring 12-year-old begins to wail. I don't want to die, he starts crying. Seeing the action from her stoop, the mother of the boys moves toward the fray. Ma'am, can you get back in your house for me? The officer says firmly. Impossible. There's a gun drawn on her child. Ma'am, ma'am, shouts the officer as she approaches. The scene fades to black. An officer is talking to two parents. We're just doing our job because a lot of people out here have guns, the officer says. A father says, you're saying they didn't have guns, but you pulled your gun on my kid? We don't know that, the officer said firmly. A mother, the one who went to her child, interrupted. Exactly, she says. They didn't have guns, but you pulled your gun on my kid. The officer responded politely. Do you understand what we're coming from? Matching description. We're not just going to walk up to someone and say, hey, do you have a gun? No one got hurt in this. Wrong place at the wrong time, obviously for this kid, said the officer. Right place at the wrong time. They were in the right place, said the child's father. The footage ends. Now, there was of course no weapon. The mother's impulse to go to her child being held at gunpoint and the confusion, fear, and frustration of the boy should make sense to most observers. Why would a mother stand by and watch while police officers point guns at her child? Why wouldn't a 12-year-old fear for his life? I suppose the family should have been thankful. No one was hurt. Much worse has happened under hauntingly similar circumstances. The boys were familiar with the cruel and remarkable history that confronts their boys each time they leave home. They lived in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after all. And like so many other American cities, Grand Rapids had commissioned a stop and frisk study that found racial disparities in police procedures. Black people were stopped twice at twice the rate of white people, but were less likely to carry guns or drugs. The wrong place at the wrong time, at a park, a playground, or a street outside their home. There is no right place for these children. Now, innocence and childhood are synonymous in most people's minds. And this is certainly the case in most of the American imagination. But for our children, which is to say black children, they're presumed guilty. I say children because this doesn't just happen to boys. 11-year-old Honesty Hodges was held at gunpoint by the Grand Rapids police around the same time as this encounter. She was made to walk backwards, her hands in the air, but in her case, from the doorway of her home. Her mother pleaded, she's only a child. The police were searching for someone who committed an act of violence. In this case, it was her aunt, a woman named Carrie Manning. This was a 42-year-old white woman who was wanted for the stabbing of her little sister. The child screamed no as they put her in handcuffs. That Honesty wasn't 42 years old or white didn't matter. This child, whose life changed all of ours, tragically died during the COVID-19 pandemic in a moment when we as a nation failed to admit that our children, especially black children, were vulnerable, in this case, vulnerable to the virus. I'm sure it was surprising when the police chief apologized to the boys' families in his public statement. Within the hour, two police officers' unions issued a joint statement of their own. The officers were following protocol, the police union said, and the protocol would not change. But how did we get here? And why is this the protocol? In some ways, this is an old story, and it'd be tempting to start with the war on drugs or the advent of modern policing. But our presumptions about black guilt and the collective sin that renders black people criminal emerges with the concept of race itself. This is because the idea of a black people, uniform and constituted as black, is itself a child of racial slavery. Before that, neither European aristocrats who called for unfree labor, nor the raiders they sent to plunder the African continent, nor the network of merchants or middlemen or brokers, nor the warrior aristocracies that captured people and supplied slaves to the coast thought of black people as a people at all. They were outsiders, foreigners like the Eastern Europeans and the so-called barbarians who were traded by warring empires. Saidiya Hartman, who's the eminent scholar of transatlantic slavery, whose work I'm drawing from here, put it best. She said, Africans did not sell their brothers and sisters into slavery. They sold strangers, those outside the web of kin and clan relationships. They were foreigners and barbarians, lawbreakers expelled from society. In order to portray your race, you had to first imagine yourself as one, she writes. And there was certainly a social hierarchy that existed, and slaves were certainly at the bottom. But the exclusive trade in Africans as slaves wasn't established, of course, until the 15th century. Now, there's a long history about the relationship between blackness and violence, but I will say here that the idea of black people as undifferentiated, naked, beastly, violent, godless gets born in this moment. And that there was violence, and not just from European raiders. African captives fought. They fought back in villages and ports and shipyards and at sea, and they rebelled in the New World colonies and in the barracoons and on the auction block. There's a whole history of resistance to capture, of course, a whole history of violence for the purpose of black freedom. Sometimes joining with indigenous people who died by the thousands resisting captivity, sometimes joining with indentured servants whose quality of life wasn't much better than a slave's. It was after these violent rebellions, these forced expressions of black freedom, that the separation of races and the collective notion of black guilt gets established. And this separation between so-called black and white people takes place across law and in everyday life. But it also takes place in culture. To combat solidarity across racial lines, white servants are given new freedoms. This is in the law. They're allowed to settle Indian land and permitted to punish enslaved free people. This is in the US. The word white gets used for the first time. We see that. But we also see cultural expressions where black people are presented in the media as being fit for certain types of treatment, certain types of labor. In this case, we see a young black child hugging a bale of cotton as if cotton farming isn't harmful to the child. And we see a white child sullen in the cotton field. This was a part of the campaign, according to Robin Bernstein, to end the practice of child labor. And while the fear of black insurrection was always palpable and white slave patrols, constables, and eventually the police stood at the ready to beat back black rebellion, the way that black people were depicted in popular culture changed. In the words of historian David Levering Lewis, when black folks got their freedom, when emancipation happened, the African American becomes demonized in popular culture, seen as a threat, a lascivious beast who roams the countryside of the South, people loosed by the end of slavery and now upon us like locusts. And now the idea of black criminality begins to preoccupy American minds. Police in the South in this moment round up thousands of black people for failing to work, for attempting to leave, for the so-called crime of being idle. The convict leasing system is born in balloons. This is an early form of mass incarceration that we see between 1865 and 1890, where the population of convicts in Southern states triples. And there's over-incarceration in the North as black workers flee racial terror to arrive in the slums of Chicago, Philadelphia, St. Louis, and New York. From the tabulation of crime statistics in such a way that erases the criminality of white immigrants in this moment, to the many wars on the poor, the war on crime, the war on drugs, to some extent the war on poverty, I'm fast-forwarding, obviously, black people are over-incarcerated and increasingly treated like criminals. This is a brief social history of black guilt from the moment of the first encounter with Africans who were viewed as undifferentiated, naked, lawless, godless. A people gets made, born in a cauldron of violence, believed to be violent themselves. And they're born out of a set of efficiencies, out of market logics, out of what one might call an efficiency because it's convenient. As efficiency, you make a people. As an efficiency, we label them violent. And this reflects some reality because of the revolts and violent revolt. And this reflects some reality because of resistance and violent resistance. And this reflects some reality because of what people learn to do to themselves when they're excluded. But the moniker of black violence was almost always deployed at moments of black freedom. The conceptualization of what we might call black violence, and by extension, black guilt, gets deployed at moments of black emancipation, which come about in the wake of, and some scholars say, because of these kinds of revolts. And this isn't just the establishment of guilt. It's the erasure of innocence, the racial innocence that we talked about. So what I call black guilt here is the result of a material relationship. It springs from material relations. In this case, the configuration of a labor market in a given moment in time, but also the change of a culture, which rises to meet, shaped, and is shaped by the needs and requirements of a changing political economy. This is true historically. I think that it's true now. And I think that we can see this by the changes in law and policy that people that we've learned to fear, people that we come to call violent, people who are overwhelmingly black or poor or minoritized, at least in my country, but it seems like everywhere else I look too, we see this, we see how the law stands up to meet them. Right now, there are 44,000 laws, policies, and sanctions that target people with criminal records, creating a new material condition, one that bars them from the political economy and culture, from the very social life of the city. In fact, it causes them to hang in the city's wake. These are policies directed at the kinds of people that we've learned to be afraid of, to protect us from the violence, from their violence in the wake of their freedom. I mentioned that there are thousands of policies barring whole groups of people from hundreds of categories of employment, thousands more that dictate where they may live or work or how they might take their leisure. And this is the through line, the presumption of violence, and a legal apparatus built up to meet them. The 1990s brought us visions of wayward black children as super predators who maraud across a dystopian landscape, echoing the thoughts about their violence. No wonder black people are twice as likely to be arrested than whites and five times more likely to be incarcerated. No wonder they serve longer sentences. No wonder unarmed black boys are 21 times more likely to be killed by the police than unarmed white boys. One study found that over a third of black boys will be arrested by the time they turn 18, and nearly half will be arrested by the time they turn 23. This is how we get to this now quite famous graph, one that we've seen many times already this morning. This, of course, is the rise in the incarceration rate in the United States, where for 27 years, we arrest more people each year than we did the year before. And the mass incarceration, at least in the United States, refers to poor black people. We know that mass incarceration is many things. It's a series of crises. It is a racial justice crisis. I mentioned the disparate rates of incarceration, with studies telling us that something like 60% of black male high school dropouts will do time, but so too will 30% of black boys who graduate. And we know that it's a public health crisis. HIV prevalence, hepatitis C prevalence is much higher in jails and prisons than it is in the general population. In fact, a study in 2009 told us that somewhere between 12 and 35% of all the people with a communicable disease passed through a jail or a prison in the year before. We know that the prison is filled with a rapidly aging population, that there are certainly negative mental health outcomes that are associated with incarceration in jails and prisons in the United States. Because it's a mental health crisis, that jails and prisons are now the largest mental health facility in the United States for 44 out of the 50 states in that country. But it's also a crisis of disability. The 38% of incarcerated people experience a disability of some kind. And it's a homelessness crisis. We know that people who've been touched by the criminal justice system are more likely to be homeless, seven times more likely. In fact, if you've been incarcerated more than once, you're 13 times more likely to experience homelessness in the United States, black women being the most housing insecure of the lot. So the question that I have is mass incarceration really a response to crime and specifically a response to violence? Or is mass incarceration about vulnerability? This is the violent crime rate that's dropping. And we remember the rate of incarceration. Mass incarceration is, in fact, a state-sanctioned act of community violence. When we think about community violence, we typically think about kids with guns. But what about this? This is a graph comparing people across sort of institutions. So we know that there are about 2 million people who are currently incarcerated, which pales in comparison to the nearly 5 million people on probation or parole in the United States on any given day. If you change the unit of analysis from a point in time count to think about the number of people who pass through an institution, which isn't fair to the statisticians in the room, but you'll allow me to do it because I'm not a statistician, please. We see that something like 10 million people a year are processed through American jails. That 19 million people are estimated to have a felony conviction in the United States. This is a population 10 times the size of the US prison system, but it's a stat that gets no love. And that Americans with criminal records, the Bureau of Justice Statistics estimates that 80 million American adults have a criminal record. This is one in three US adults. Community is where the action is. This is an act of violence on community. And the prison, despite its place in the public's imagination, is one relatively small slice of a vast carceral network. This is a screenshot of the National Inventory of the Collateral Consequences of a Criminal Conviction. I want to talk about why I talk about this is a form of state violence. And so what they did was they counted the number of laws, policies, and administrative sanctions across the 50 states in the United States that target people with records, and they came up with 44,000. But the devil is in the details. In my home state, I'm from Chicago, Illinois. There are 1,400 laws, policies, or sanctions. This includes 583 that limit the acquisition of business licenses and property rights, 186 that limit political and civic participation, 54 that constrain family and domestic rights, 21 that limit access to housing. So what this means is that in most states, you can't hold public office. In my home state of Illinois, you couldn't groom a dog until a legislative change happened. You may not adopt or foster a kid, you may have to give up your parental rights, you may not live in public housing. What happens is your relationships with everyone else looks fundamentally different. This is a question of citizenship, which is to say a question of political belonging. This act of community violence erodes one's relationship to the demos. This is because there are unique restrictions, unique rights, and unique responsibilities for people who've been targeted by the criminal justice system, which at this point in US history is 1 in 2 American families. This is a different experience of the Democratic Project for this group than it is for everyone else. So maybe I'll talk a little bit about what this feels like and what this looks like when it comes home. And I want to talk about a brother who committed an act of violence, an actually existing act of violence. I want to talk about someone I call Lorenzo, who is a drug robber. This is to say that he robs dope dealers. This is what he does for a living. And Lorenzo had hurt many people. He had shot people. He had harmed people, but he did his time. He did 9 years in this last bit, and he was on his way home. And so he told me about what happened when he was released. He's given a sheet of paper called the conditions of release, and he's told to report to a halfway house on the south side of Chicago. And he goes and he knocks on the door and he meets the person at the front. Conditions of release are the things that you can't do and the things that you must do. It's a sheet of paper you get handed when you walk out of a prison's gate. And the person welcomed him and took his paperwork, and he goes over the rules. No guests, no pets, no smoking. You get a something called a link card. This is a public welfare card for food stamps, for you to be able to buy food provisions. And what they would do is they would collect these for the 15 or so men that he would be bunkmates with, and they'd share the food among the group. And Lorenzo had to pay $400 a month, which doesn't seem like a lot. But remember, there are 18,000 labor market restrictions for people with criminal records. Lorenzo couldn't get a job. So now, here's Lorenzo. This is his 28th day of almost freedom, and he owes $400 on the 30th. So he gathers his things in a black plastic garbage bag, because he had been many things in his life. He had been to many prisons. He had been to juvenile detention, but he had never been homeless. He hadn't experienced it. And he began to walk the neighborhood thinking about his life and what he would do, how he would get his hands on the $400 that he owed. Now, this is a halfway house. This was more like what my grandmother might have called a flop house. It's not like their tenants' rights that applied to Lorenzo. He could be put out on a whim. There'd be no notice. If he didn't pay the money, he'd be on the street. Oh, and by the way, not having an address to report to is a violation of Lorenzo's parole, meaning his probation officer could send him back to prison for that very reason. In fact, about 25% of all prison admissions each year are for revocations of parole for problems just like this. So here's Lorenzo walking the block. He's in a neighborhood he had never been to. This is 79th Street in Cottage Grove. This is in Chicago. It's not to be too specific. Sorry about that. And what does he see? He says, two little dope boys standing on the corner flashing their little cash. That's what Lorenzo sees. He sees two drug dealers. He said he didn't know what to do, but I knew he knew what to do, so I asked him. He said, I had muscle memory. I felt like I could have choked one and taken their money, but I didn't want to go back to prison. So here's Lorenzo on the 28th day of his almost freedom, standing at a corner, needing $400, looking at two boys flashing their money. I asked Lorenzo what he did, but the question is really, what would you have done in that situation? We'll come back to this. This is the price of carceral citizenship. This is exclusion from the political economy and culture. This is laws on top of laws that promote particular forms of crime, particular forms of violence, different sets of expectations for you and for people like you than there are for anyone else. Violence of all kinds is the primary response to the presumption of your potential for violence. A kind of administrative violence, the violence of exclusion, exclusion from the labor market, exclusion from culture. But violence produces violence. And it's not just like this in the United States, where we see forms of social exclusion that are directed toward people who we're afraid of. You know, we heard a little bit this morning about the rightward shift in politics. I was on a podcast for a Swedish station. The program was called Dystopia, and they asked me to come on to talk about sentencing, the sentencing in the United States, because Sweden, in response to the crime that's happening in pockets of you know, Middle Eastern folks largely, is starting to adopt punitive crime policy. It's ratcheting up its sentencing. It's ratcheting it up its punitiveness. And the U.S. case was the dystopian case in this case. But we see this not just in Sweden. Of course, you all know about the punishment of Muslim North African migrants, Middle Eastern folks from post-colonial states here. But we also see this in the UK, where black and people, black and Asian folks, experience stop and frisk at similar rates to people in the United States. But there's also the violence of disdain, which is a different kind of violence. I could point to the case of Sarah Reed. She's a woman who in 2003 had lost her child. She had a little baby who died. I could tell you about the five times she went to the hospital to talk to the workers there about the baby not breathing, and the five times she got turned away, and how on the fifth time the baby died because the baby had muscular atrophy. And I could talk to you about how and why Sarah had a nervous breakdown, and how she was never quite the same, how she had visions of this child, and this, what she said was, this child's bodily fluids followed her. But what I want to tell you about is her incarceration in 2012, because she was caught shoplifting out of a Uniqlo department store, and how the officer, seeing her need, responded to her vulnerability with violence. She didn't respond to his commands, so he's caught on CCTV beating her and dragging her across the floor. But her story doesn't end this violence of disdain, this particular kind of violence that begets from the exclusion of people that we're afraid of. Sarah goes to Holloway Prison. She's admitted to psychiatric care, unsurprisingly, and someone tries to sexually assault her. She fights off her assaulter and is charged with assault herself. She's found hung in her cell eventually. This is a terrible story. This is why we have to listen to people who have criminal records. James Baldwin says famously, if you want to know how justice is administered in the country, but not just that, if you want to know whether or not a country has any love for justice, he says, don't go to the judge or the policeman. Don't go to the protected members of a society. He says, ask any Mexican, any Puerto Rican, any black man, any poor person, ask the wretched how they fare in the halls of justice. And then you will know not whether or not a country is just. You will know whether or not it has any love for justice or any concept of it. Now, I'd like to tell you that this isn't the end of Lorenzo's story, the brother who was on the corner. When I asked Lorenzo what he did, he told me he stood on that corner and he cried. He just cried. He didn't want to go back to prison. He didn't want to rob these boys because he knew he'd get caught. He didn't want to engage in the violence that he had engaged in for so many years before. And so he remembered a halfway house that he heard about while he was in prison, and he got on a bus and he rode an hour and a half to get to the halfway house. It was far, a completely different neighborhood. And they didn't have room for him. But the program manager at the halfway house told Lorenzo, if you just sleep on this couch, we'll let you sleep on this couch until a room in the program opens. And he did. And Lorenzo did well. He got hired. He did the program. He got hired as a groundskeeper. He got promoted, became a house manager. Eventually, he became the executive director. He's the director of the program now. He's in wonderful shape. He runs the organization. And this aligns with what we know about human development, that if people are given an opportunity, if they're given a place in the world, if they're given the things that they need, they tend to do well. They turn from lives of crime and violence. But this is also a story of state failure. It's when people and organizations fill in the gaps that are produced by state failure. So how do we get free? I think we have to advocate for law and policy change. How do we get to a different world where we don't respond to the needs of the vulnerable as if it's a threat? I think we have to change law and policy. I think we have to provide a bridge to resource-rich institutions. And we see this all across the United States even, from what we call fair chance housing that thinks differently about people with criminal records, where organizations like the New York Human Rights Commission thinks about people with, a better example is the movement in Atlanta that thinks about people with records as members of a protected class, which means that they will sue on their behalf if they're discriminated against. I think we have to push to make legislative wins retroactive. It's not enough to do a thing at one time, one moment in time. Beyond piecemeal reforms, though, I think we have to promote the intrinsic humanity of people that we've learned to fear. But more importantly, I think we have to listen to people that we've thrown away. The most effective social change campaigns make room for directly impacted people, not just to participate, but to lead. We've seen this in the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the LGBTQ movement, and it must be this way for the movement for people who've been marked by the criminal justice system. We have to change our focus, though, above all, from one of public safety, because I think this is a move that happens in fear, to one where we consider the thriving of the individuals, human thriving, human flourishing as the goal. But we also have to get close, because there's a kind of violence that we'll never see. This community violence that happens through law and policy that I've been talking about this whole time, that promotes particular kinds of violence and it pulls it out of people. So what would it mean to welcome someone who's caused harm instead of reject them through our law and policy mechanisms? I'll leave you with one last story. I want to tell you about a dear friend of mine named Ronald Simpson Bay. And I could tell you a lot about his story. He tells it much better than I can. He is a leading advocate in the fight to change criminal law and policy in the United States. But I'll give you the contours of his story. Ronald was wrongfully convicted. The crime was shooting at a police officer. A police officer had gotten shot. The bullet had grazed his finger. And he pinpointed Ronald as the person who did it. But Ronald wasn't at the scene of the crime, and he was given 50 years. So Ronald's sitting in a prison cell on a 50-year sentence for a crime he didn't commit. And about a decade into that sentence, his only son was murdered by a 14-year-old boy. This is a terrible time for Ronald. And I just want to know how he made it. And he said that, you know, in those early days, it was really hard to be around him. He said he was in the hole for one reason or another, just kind of all the time. And then he said he had read a book. You know, he was always sort of a smart guy. He'd always been reading. But he read a book and he came across a line that said, I am a vital force among forces. You know, I refuse to be the victim of a preordained destiny. And Ronald made a decision. He said, when I stopped being angry, I looked up, is what he said. And what he decided to do was he went and he advocated for the boy who killed his son, that he be tried as a juvenile instead of an adult. There's some context here. This happened in the state of Michigan. Michigan was the leader in the United States of incarcerating children and giving them adult sentences when they were incarcerated. So if the boy who killed Ronald's son had went to prison, he'd have been gone for the rest of his life, like Ronald was. He was written off. So I asked why he advocated for this child. I wondered if the child was special. You know, was he involved in political programs? Was he particularly smart? No, he could have worked at McDonald's for all Ronald cared. Did he love the boy, I asked him. He couldn't love him. This was someone who murdered his only son. Did you forgive him? He said, forgiveness without works is dead. Well, why'd you do it, Ronald? He said, I did it because it was the right thing to do. I did it because it was the right thing to do, not because of how he felt, not because of the weight of the moment, not to star in a documentary or something like that. He did it because it was right. Ronald engaged in radical hospitality. He left himself open. This requires a kind of vulnerability. Our law and policy isn't run through by, you know, doesn't allow for vulnerability. It is a shield to protect ourselves from the harm of others. He made an ethical commitment. And he did what that commitment required, he told me. And he embraced the boy, not in some deep way. The boy doesn't live with him, but he made it so that the boy would have a place in the world. And this to me is how we get a better world. We know this from all forms of violence intervention programs that have any success at all, that what they do is they allow for people to have a place in the world. They allow for people to have work, a place to stay. They value them and show them that they're valued. And when I've talked over time to people who've shot at other people and who've put their guns down, when I ask them why, they say, because I have a place here. Because this brother over there picks up the phone when I call him at 2 a.m. is what they say over and over again. 100+ years of criminological research tells us that housing instability, unemployment, that the severing of social ties leads to more crime, not less. The recent research on crime reduction tells us that access to employment, that housing stability, that pro-social bonds, that allowing people to move up and in their society, which is to say something that looks like a healthy welfare state, is a crime and violence reduction strategy that works. I think we have to ask ourselves new kinds of questions, and I think we get to those questions by getting close to people who are directly impacted by the issues that we seek to know about. I've tried to ask new questions in my work. I tried to ask some new empirical questions. I've tried to ask some new theoretical questions. But the question before us is really an ethical one. I think we've made a world of exclusion. I think that exclusion leads to more violence. I think that that exclusion is a kind of violence. The question for us, though, is what kind of world do we want? Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.